Today's talk is on English poetry, or Old English poetry, of course, the birth of English poetry, because this pretty much is where it starts. And of course, I start with Beowulf, for it is he, and we will be talking about him a bit later on. And what I want to try and do is get across some general points about Old English poetry, talk about the poetry collections, where they actually reside. Go back, if you remember, in the first lecture I said about performance, authorship, audience, so we're going to have a look at those three aspects. Technicalities of Old English poetry, and throughout we'll be looking at some Old English poems. However, before we start, a topical digression, kind of topical, and this actually leads into the rest of the lecture, but anyway, let's start with that. So, this is how the Anglo-Saxons calculated or named their months. If you have a look, here's our months, January to December. Here's what Bede called them in the early 8th century. This is normalised Late West Saxon, just show you spelling differences. And as you can see, they bear very little to no resemblance to our modern month scheme, apart from Yule, which was their January, which of course survived in Yule log, and we're coming up to Yule. They're actually really, really good month names, far better than this nonsense here. For example, Easter Moyoneth is obviously where Easter time. Pre-milker, which is when you can milk your animals quite a lot, so you get quite a lot of milk. And as we're heading into it, winter filleth, so you're filling up your baskets and your stores for winter. And blot moneth, blood month, when you start slaughtering the animals for Christmas to try and get you through the winter. Now that's how we should name months, but unfortunately we went with the Gregorian equivalent. However, we did keep hold of their days, as I mentioned, which doesn't really matter too much on a calendar. So this is the names of the days, named after the sun, the moon. And these, of course, tend to indicate really old pagan relics, that Tuesday is named after Tew, Woden, Thor, etc. So those names do survive in our days of the week. And I think I mentioned that right at the beginning. If you want to find out how they thought about time and days, etc., go and read Bede there. Now, why am I talking about this? So we're going to have two different strands, and it's all going to come together, okay? Bit about the days is interesting, because normally we say a day starts at just gone midnight, and that's the day. So what are we, Thursday today, so Friday will start just gone midnight. But the Anglo-Saxons didn't calculate days like that or think of days like that. They thought the day started the next day when the sun goes down, so whatever it is, half five, whatever, today, that will be Friday, that will be the start of Friday. So it was important to them, the evening before the day. Whoops. Christianity, this is you might not think this is related, but it is related, arrives in Britain or England again in 597. It was there before, but that's St. Augustine's mission. Okay, so let's keep with the Christianity first. What did they do? How did they go about trying to convert people to Christianity? They didn't just go through and say, you're wrong. Everything you thought about up to now is complete nonsense. What they did was something called appropriation. They would take the beliefs of the Anglo-Saxons, and they did this throughout the world, actually, and try and appropriate it and change it. So Easter, you may wonder where the Easter. Easter is actually a pagan deity, we think, and they just took that name and turned it into Easter, so that's why we have that name. Okay, so that's that little strand. And here, thus, Arvan, or evening, is part of the next day. So a good appropriation that the Christians did was they looked around and they found these various feasts. One was Samhain, the Celtic feast. All around the same time, the Norse feast of Vitnatra, which they appropriated, and they called this the Feast of All Hallows. Evening before something still resides. It was important to them all the time, but we still have a couple. Midsummer's Eve, that's why we talk about that, because that's important. Christmas Eve, Christmas, obviously, 25th of December. The chances of that actually being the birthday of Christ are fairly remote, but again, it's an appropriation of a pagan belief and feast. So evenings, again, hang on. Now you can see where this is heading. The actual summer, end of the summer, which was what they were appropriating there, made the Feast of All Hallows. This is what they believed. This is what the Germanic people believed, like the Celtic Canaanite people used to celebrate this night by lighting large bonfires to frighten spirits and demons, because on this night they freely roamed the world, and it was also on this night that Odin, or Woden, to the Anglo-Saxons, was supposed to lead the spectral horsemen and hounds in the wild hunt. And the wild hunt goes all the way to May Eve, which is Walpurgisnacht. So, if you take that all together, you can probably guess what we're talking about, 31st of October. All Hallows Eve, All Hallows Day, as the Allra Hallgener, Ealra Halgena Arven, Halgena Arven Halloween. Okay, so that's where we get that. So why I'm bringing this together is it's showing you that in Old English or the Anglo-Saxon period, you get a fusion, in this case between Christianity and pagan beliefs, and you get appropriation, so they pick up things. And this is a theme which we get in the poetry, that's why I'm trying to say that. They obviously did believe there was something slightly odd about this, about Halloween. What this basically says is, but we heard say certain man that that no man will live if he lets blood on All Hallows Mass Day on the 1st of November, or if he's wounded. So if you get wounded or you draw blood on the 1st of November, you'll die. Tables of Lucky and Unlucky Day, it's a text in Old English, but of course it was written down by Christian monks. So they obviously still had these beliefs floating about, which we wouldn't believe now. So what does this tell you? You can learn a lot about today from yesterday, or you can learn a lot about Saturday from yesterday. Anglo-Saxon England is a fusion, different languages, different beliefs, Christian pagan and Christian missionaries appropriated material. So put that to the back of your mind, because it will all come towards the end of this lecture. Right, Old English poetry. So, shout out time. What Old English poems do you know, have you heard of? Beowulf. Thank God. Okay, yes, Beowulf, yes.
The Wanderer.
The Wanderer, good. Dream of the Rood. Cadman's Song, yes, or Cadman's Hymn, which is on your handout. Gawain and Green Knight's Middle English, so it's a bit later. Seafarer, good. Battle of Maldon, I heard. What was it? The Ruin. Someone remembers my lectures. Okay, good, good. That's good. You've heard of quite a few. Here's a few more for you. This isn't everything. I remember I was looking at this the other day. I've forgotten the Battle of Maldon, unless I've put it in twice. But anyway, this is a list of some of the Old English poems that you may or may not encounter. Beowulf starting. I mean, Beowulf probably much accounts for, in terms of line numbers, all the rest of them. But you can look through the names and perhaps you can see some things leaping out. There's the emergency name Christ 1, followed by Christ 2, and the sequel Christ 3. Guthlac A, St. Guthlac, and then there is a Guthlac B, it's just hanging over there, and things like that. But if you look, even look at the titles, you'll see that a lot of them are referring to the Christian story, the Old and the New Testament. So we have Genesis, Exodus, Daniel, the Old and New Testament, and then anything about Christ is the New Testament. There are things about battles, the Battle of Brunanburg, the Fight of Finsbury, the Battle of Maldon. There are heroic poems such as Beowulf, which mixes everything. And there are the elegies, the Ruin, and so on and so forth. And then there are poems which you just, where do you put them? Like the Seafarer, like the Wanderer, which tend to deal with more psychological themes. They're psychoanalytic poetry, if you like. So, Old English poetry. It survives pretty much in four manuscripts, four books. If they hadn't survived, you wouldn't be here. You might be cursing the fact that they survived, but anyway, they did. Four manuscripts, and they're all written in around a 50-year period. That's when they write the text down, okay? 975 to 1025. What you often also find, because there's only four, is that there's one copy of a poem. So that's got all kinds of things we've got to think about there. But anyway, one copy of the poem. And if it's damaged, tough. You've just got to try and work around it, as we saw earlier on. So the manuscripts, as they are called, are there's the Beowulf manuscript, which is actually given, this is its proper title, British Library, Cotton Vitellius A15. Does anyone know about why things are called Cotton and Vitellius? Okay. There was a collector called Sir Robert Cotton who collected manuscripts in the 17th century, so that's him, and he had them all in his little library, and on each bookcase it had a bust of a person from the classical period, so in this case Vitellius, but you get Otho, Cleopatra, etc. And then it'd be shelf A, B, C, D, and then it'd be book along. So we know that this was on shelf A, it was the 15th book along, on the little cabinet that had a bust of Vitellius on it. Unfortunately, maybe it's because he called his house Ashburnham House, it burnt down. And we lost a lot of manuscripts in 1731, I think it was. It's also called the Book of Monsters, but we won't go into that. The second one is about half a mile that way, whatever. It's in Bodleian Library. We call it the Junius Manuscript. The third one ends up in Italy. It's in Vercelli. We call it the Vercelli book, not surprisingly, and it's a manuscript full of poems and other things as well, but it's sitting there, which is probably a pilgrimage route to Rome, so someone had this along with them, either gave it when they got to Vercelli or forgot it, probably unlikely, but anyway, it's ended up there. And the fourth one, which has loads and loads of poems, is sitting in Exeter Cathedral. There are fragments, etc., going around, all around the place, a few bits and bobs here, later transcripts, but that's it. Pretty much all the poems you will come across are from those four manuscripts. And here is probably the most famous poem, or one of the most famous poems in English literature. That is Beowulf. That is the start of Beowulf. And you can tell pretty much immediately, this is not a gloriously illuminated manuscript. They probably didn't think too much of this. They just wrote it down. I mean, they didn't even bother to get around to colouring in the H. As you can see, they just kind of got around. That's it. What you're seeing around the edge here, by the way, is sellotape, or the Victorian equivalent of it. Because what happened was, this was one of the manuscripts that got burnt in that fire, chucked it out the window, oh, this place is burning down. They get it back, they have these things, and they think, what they do, there's all these loose pages. They put them in between two cards, and they sellotape them down. Not exactly a way you would want to handle the Beowulf manuscript, but anyway. So that's a manuscript. But also in Old English, this is a manuscript. It may not look like a manuscript, but it is. This is the Ruthwell cross, and around the edges, I think I showed you this in the first lecture, are runic inscriptions, which are some lines from a poem called The Dream of the Rood, which someone shouted out. So even when we talk about manuscripts, it's confusing in the Old English period because there's so many other things we have to look at. Okay, some key points about Old English poems. First of all those titles you saw, we've made them up. The Anglo-Saxons did not title their poetry. And this can be slightly confusing because you might read older editions from many, many years ago and you think, oh, wow, I've never heard of that poem. And it's actually the same poem you've been reading, but someone just gave it a different title. Undated, we have no idea when these things were written. With the exception of something like the Battle of Maldon, it can't have been written before the battle, quite obviously. And the battle was in 991, so we know that it was written around then or after or much later. What we do know, they were written down in those manuscripts around that period, but when they were composed, when they were put together, is a matter for a lot of discussion. And also, they're anonymous. We don't know anything about the poets. With two exceptions, we know the names of two Old English poets.
Alfred.
Who?
Alfred.
No, Alfrich is a prose writer, but it's a good point because he plays around with poetry, but he is a prose writer. Cadman, good, yeah, he's on the front of your handout, actually, or he should be, these poems. Cadman, okay. Do you want to know the other one?
Bede.
Well, Bede writes in Latin, but he does actually record Cadman's hymn down. Yeah, someone said it, Cynewulf. Good, okay. So we know name of two poets. We know very, very little about them. We know a bit about Cadman. This is it. This is Cadman's complete works. And the story is that he's in Whitby. Bede writes this story down, so obviously it's pre-730s when Bede's writing his book, but so sometime in the 7th century. He's this little sort of nondescript character in the abbey. They all start having a party. They all start singing songs or reciting poetry. He says, oh, I'm out of here. I don't know how to do that. Runs away to a little shed, falls asleep, gets woken up by an angel. The angel says, sing me a song. And he says, I can't sing. And he says, oh, yes, you can. And Cadman sings Cadman's hymn, and Bede records it down. And that basically is the first poem in English that we have. Great, isn't it? Anyway, he did write other stuff, but we've all lost it. So we know a bit about Cadman, but there we are. That is his poem, Cadman's hymn, and it's on the front of your handout. And you will see, if you look at the Old English, it kind of breaks down into the rules we expect of Anglo-Saxon poetry. Cynewulf, we have four poems from Cynewulf. We don't know anything about Cynewulf apart from his name. And what happens is, in these four poems, you will see the Old English here, every now and then some runes appear, usually towards the end. And it's usually in a text or something about saying, like, remember me or think of me. And in those four poems, when you put the runes together, they spell Cynewulf, which is kind of like him saying, look, please remember me. But we don't know who he is, we just know his name. He has a certain style, and those are the runes. C-U-I-E, over there. That's how they follow. Some people think even Cynewulf doesn't exist, because if you put it together, it's possibly to do with the life of a sheep or the relationship of life of sheep. So it's a joke about manuscripts, because that's where manuscripts come from. But anyway, I like to think of someone called Cynewulf who thought, Well, one day if I people might read this and think of me. I think of him. Anyway. So back to these poems. Okay, all kinds of things there. And what I want to do here, because you may have read a lot of these, or you may have read some of these poems, and you even look at the title, you think, God, they're dull. And they're not. They're very good. They're very interesting because they do all kinds of fascinating things. But I'm going to pick on the riddles, which we had a look at yesterday in the grammar class, and I'm going to talk about, we're going to have a look at three riddles. So riddles are, as they say, they are short poems, a bit like that moth riddle, and it's a puzzle. They would have read these out, and you would have had to guess them. So you can imagine you're at a party, a feast, whatever. Everyone's drunk, everyone gets to the and then, so I'm not hearing Beowulf again, I know the ending. And anyway, it's 3,000 lines long. I've got a good one, I've got a really good riddle. And you tell the riddle, and then everyone have to guess it. It's a game, it's entertainment, it's what probably they used to do. So, a riddle. What's the answer? Anyone? Anchor. Well done. Yeah, it's an anchor. It's an anchor speaker. And this is kind of common for a riddle. It's the object talking to you. I, the anchor. And it describes itself in very vague terms. And then you know my stature. Now guess my name. And you can imagine you're just saying that. And they're all going, oh, I don't know. Is it a big fish or something like that? You go, no, it's an anchor. Let's see this one. I like this one. I don't like the translation, but I like it. It's a good one. Anyone? Well, the clue is... Nope. The clue is that another woman is fitting me out under her soft garments as her own children... But then, yeah, it's a cuckoo. She had less of her own sons and daughters because of what she did. Which is kind of a really nice way of describing a cuckoo. It's not just saying, oh, I'm a bird and I lay my egg in someone else's nest. What am I? You do it in a sort of cryptic way. Okay, now, these are contained in the Exeter book. There isn't a bit at the bottom of the manuscript. You turn it up and you get the answer, okay? So we are kind of putting on our answers to these and guessing them. And some of them we have no idea what they are. I mean, these run into the dozens, nearly 100 of them. Okay, one more. Absolutely, onion. I don't know what they were thinking about. Yeah, of course it's an onion. That's obvious, isn't it? Standing erect in bed, you start crying, etc., etc., etc. Hairy underneath. What else could it be? Well, of course, we know what else it could be, and that's why you were kind of laughing. Because, and there are a few of these. There are a few of these sexual innuendo riddles which play on certain things, and you can imagine, you know, this how this would have gone down. Now, of course, the interesting thing is this was written down by a monk. Some people say, you see, the riddle, the monks were interested in the riddles because it explained the complexities of God's creation, etc., etc., and you took it back. I think that's rubbish. I just thought these were dirty jokes they used to tell each other just for a bit of a laugh to liven up monastic life. Seaside postcards, carry-on films, even the so-called alternative comedians which appeared in the 80s all fall back to these standard smutty jokes. And why I like this is because you will be reading The Wanderer, you will be reading The Seafarer, you'll read The Dream in the Room, and you think these were extremely serious people. But maybe those are the poems that people just decided to write down, and it's just by chance we get these things. And these give us a kind of glimpse of what they found funny, what amused them. And there's something kind of, if you take a step back, something... magical is the wrong word, but realising that people 1,000 years ago found things funny that, well, maybe you don't, but a lot of people in modern day Britain do. Okay, analysing poetry. So, standard thing, literal, thematic, stylistic, okay? Don't try applying this to the onion riddle, you won't get very far. There isn't much thematic analysis going on there, but as I said yesterday, if we took the moth riddle, literally, what's it about? It's a bookworm, an insect, but also a person who reads books. Thematic, what's the main message of the poem? And you tend to look, as we talk about a bit later, allegorical, moral and spiritual, but reading is pointless unless you understand information, and stylistic, and I told you there, he broadens out from a moth to he, so the subject becomes wider, and then he focuses more on from words to the strong foundation, which I would argue is the teachings of Christ. Okay, so that's how you would analyse a poem. But as I said, the onion riddle or the riddle about a key, I'll leave you to imagine what that can be about. Don't do it. Okay, so on to those three things. Performance. Poetry was entertainment. I've already touched on that in terms of like the riddle, but it was entertainment. And the first question people often say was it sung? Because you hear words about singing songs, and Cadman talks about, I can't sing anything. Well, here's a manuscript image from the Anglo-Saxon period where we have a person here, I think it's King David, but he has a sort of harp which looks very much like the harp which we found in Sutton Hoo, and you can see these guys playing the trumpet and what have you, and these just getting down and having a bit of a dance, etc. So they obviously had a musical world, but whether they applied that to their poetry, who knows? Well, this is a clip from the 70s, as you will tell by the clothing, but this person obviously took it a bit far. I don't think so. Try doing that for 3,300 lines. Actually, they'd hit you with an axe before you got to the 50th line. But anyway, there we are. So there is this conjecture about music, and someone was talking yesterday about this performance at British Library, where there is some musical accompaniment, but generally one would imagine it would be the odd strum here and there to give it a bit of intonation. But it was entertainment, and Sidney's quote here, The Defence of Poetry, is pretty much sums up what my view of Old English poetry. He, the Shope, that's what we call a poet in Old English poetry, Sidney doesn't say the Shope, cometh to you with words set in delightful proportion, either accompanied with or prepared for the well-enchanting skill of music, and with a tale forsooth he cometh unto you with tale, which holdeth children from play and old men from the chimney corner. And that's what the poetry was there for. It was there to entertain. It was there to capture the imagination. Now, it is very easy just to get yourself in a mindset of translating and looking at Mitchell and Robinson and just working your way through the poems drudgely. You've got to try and get away from that and think about how these poems would have gone down with the audience in the style that we think they were performed. As he said there, they were generally performed, we think, in some sort of feast. They would have come up after dinner entertainment. The poet, the shop, the creator would have walked in and told the tale, and everyone would have listened and cheered and what have you. So let's try a bit of an experiment. Right, so now you've got to do a bit of an imaginative leap. I can't see, so I've got a bike light. Okay, so bit of difficult. I know we're in a 1960s, 70s lecture theatre, but I want you to imagine you're not. That's very difficult. I want you to imagine you're in a mead hall, okay? Dark, it's night time, you're in a mead hall, you've just all had a feast, and in comes the poet and he starts to tell you a song or tell you a tale. Outside it's raining, outside it's thundering, whatever. You know that in an hour or so, or if you want to go to the loo, you're going to have to go out there into the darkness, and out there there's nasty things. And he comes along and he tells you the story of Beowulf. Now, I'm going to pick it up at the point where the people in the poem are in a hall and this monster called Grendel, who's been going in and killing them all, comes in and bursts in. And I want to try and you can shut your eyes, whatever. Listen to the Old English, listen to the Modern English, and try and picture yourself what this must have been like. Okay. Come on one renicht, Shridan Shedugenga. Then out of the night came the shadow stalker, stealthy and swift. The hall guards were slack, asleep at their posts, all except one. One man was in fighting mood. Tha com of more on the miscleothum Grendel Gongan, goddess Ira Bar. In off the moors, down through the mistbands, god-cursed Grendel came greedily loping. The bane of the race of the men roamed forth, hunting for a prey in the high hall. Wode under Walken unto thus the he win wretched gold seller gumina, ye awast wissa, fatum fachna. Under the cloud mark he moved towards it until it shone above him, a sheer keep of fortified gold. Duru sono anan, fear bendum fast, sithan he hear a fulman hondran. The iron braced door turned on its hinge with his hands touched it. On brada beola hudig, tha he ye bolgan was wretchedest mudan. Rather after don on funya floor feon tredode, eode iramod.
Then his rage boiled over. He ripped open the mouth of the building, maddening for blood, pacing the length of the patterned floor with his loathsome tread. Him of Eargum stored Liga Yelichos Leocht Unfair, with a baleful light, flame more than light, flared from his eyes. Tha his mod Achtlog. Minta that a yedalda, edon day quoma, ato aglacha, anra ya wilches leaf with leecher, and his glee was demonic. Picturing the mayhem before morning, he would rip life from limb and devour them.
Okay, so that's what you've got to try and picture with the poetry. Move away from this idea that it's just, if I can turn this damn light off, if it's just in the book, printed, okay, think to performance. Try imagine yourself going out into the toilet after that. It wouldn't be too easy. Okay, so perform for an audience. Make it memorable. That's probably why alliteration's in there, rhyme's in there, because everyone writes that. It's like Brave New World. Right, write it down. Alliteration, rhyme. Okay, do it in a way that they would listen to. You'll hear that alliteration coming at you all the time, internal rhyme. Wow, this is great. You're hooked. And if you want, the bums on seats, the as you like it concept, give them what they want. What do the punters want? Well, they want stories, tales, themes that they understand, that relate to them. They want what we call type scenes. They want familiar things coming in. And I'll talk about that in a second. And technically, they were probably astute to know what was good or bad poetry. So what did they want? Let's think of those ideas. Heroes. Now, you're fine with heroes and bravery in battles. There's lots of them. They wanted loyalty and feuds. You see these coming up in their poetry again and again. They wanted also deeper poetry, meditations on life, faith, the harsher aspects of life, and particularly how what it was like to live outside of society if you were exiled. What did that mean to you, as in the poem The Wanderer? It probably meant certain death. And common type scenes. So what I mean here are these are little scenes that as they appear in the poetry, it triggers something in your mind. I'll talk a bit more about this in Lecture 5, but a good example is The Beasts of Battle. If you're reading a poem and suddenly a raven or a wolf starts appearing, you know there's going to be a battle because these are the beasts that will feed on the corpses of the dead. And they used to trigger those out and then you go, ah, right, battle time, and things like that. And there are other type scenes which we see in there. Okay, heroes. You're fine with heroes if you have someone like Beowulf. He's a classic hero. He's a young man, comes in, kills people, kills monsters, goes off and kills dragons. You've got a bit of a problem with Christ, though, because Christ isn't a hero for the Germanic people. Basically, if you think of the story, he's dragged to the cross, he's crucified, and he dies. This is not Thor, this is not Odin. And that's why when you read Old English poetry, they turn Christ into this military hero. He marches up to the cross, and they particularly like the scenes where he goes down into hell, Harrow's hell on the day of before the resurrection, and kicks ass with the demons. So they turn him into a military hero, which is fascinating stuff. Now think of those other themes, exile, etc. Is exile something? Loneliness, is that something, whatever, or feuds? Well, let's start with feuds. Classic film. It's just a feud. It's a feud story. One family fighting another, the lone hero in the middle. But more recently, The Wire, if you think about that, the whole first series and the second series to a certain degree, is about a feud. It is about a feud between two rival drug-dealing gun gangs. What I particularly like about The Wire, particularly those at that early series, is that it really does build on sort of almost like Anglo-Saxon early tribal cultures, because you have the young warriors trying to impress the older warriors, which is exactly what was happening there. Loneliness, exile, well, as I said, exile pretty much meant a death sentence because there was no one to protect you. You would wander around. That's why The Wanderer is a particularly powerful poem. There was no lord to protect him, no one to feed him, no one, because the legal system was basically pretty ropey at that time. But you can be lonely while you're in society. And some of the ideas which you get in the poetry is exactly as typical to De Niro's Taxi Driver or the Beatles' Eleanor Rigby. So what I'm just trying to say in a very laboured way is that the themes may seem distant, but they're not. You can start applying them. And I would actually argue that some of the things we find in Old English poetry are a damn sight more relevant to our life nowadays than you'll find in other things. Certainly other periods of literature, and I won't mention her name. Okay, Old English poetry, because it has to get edited out. The technicalities of Old English poetry. Okay, so the mechanics. Each half line, okay? So we have a line in poetry. You can have a look at Cabman's hymn. And it's in two half lines, okay? And we call these A and B, or on verse, off verse. And then running down that, you have a white blank, or usually printed off, but it's a caesura. And they would have heard these things. Half line, minimum four syllables, two stresses, and they usually fall on meaningful elements in the half line. Don't worry about writing this down, the slides will all be on WebLearn, but they're linked by alliteration, which you already know. And the stresses alliterate, so you have two stresses, one or two, in this first half line, alliterating with the second one. So I'll give you an example of that. By the way, that's how Stephen Fry describes Anglo-Saxon poetry. Reality, a syzygy of dipodic hemistichs. He's kind of right. I wouldn't agree with the dipodic, as I'm sure you all agree. So, a line on 525 from Beowulf. Grimragudha yiftu grendlis deast. Standard. So we can see the alliteration. Grimra, Gudha, Grendlis. Okay, so there's our two stresses in the first half line, the A line, one in the second. We have four syllables, okay? And then, if you say the line, Grimra, Gudha, what we're marking here is stress, unstress, stress, unstress. And if you have a look on your handout, but don't worry if you haven't got it, I think I've got it coming up. Sorry, no, I haven't, or maybe I have somewhere. You will see a table of a series of slashes and X's and slashes and X's, okay? And that is what we call Seaver's five type. It is coming later, but But bear in mind that thing like that. Stress, unstress, stress, unstress. Okay, just to tell you it's relevant, of course, Auden used to write quite a bit of his poetry imitating the meter and style of Old English poetry. Why? Because he was a student here and taught by Tolkien. So that table there, this is the what you were looking at possibly in your handout. Now, why is this interesting and what the hell does this mean? It looks gibberish, but it isn't. Basically, a chappie called Seavers in 1885 went through all of Old English poetry, good luck to the man, and he worked out that the half lines fall into five basic patterns, like these, but we call them D as a couple there, so A, B, C, D, E. So you might see a line described as Edwards or Seavers type A, Seavers type B, but occasionally it's stress, unstress, stress, unstress, unstress, stress, unstress, stress. And you can go through Old English poetry and these half lines tend to fall into these patterns. And it's extraordinary. If you want, you can think of them like that. You're not quite right, but if you've been grilled in things like trochees and iambs and things like that, you might want to add them there. But I put the question mark there because it's not exactly true. So here is a section of Beowulf, and you can see the type of thing that some people do. They go through each half line and they try and work out, is it an Edwards, Seavers, D, E, A, E, and so on. Lecture 5 on films, on movies, we'll come back to that. Okay, poetic style. So, you have alliteration, we all know what that is, but you can also have double alliteration, oh yes, or ornamental alliteration, so the alliteration might be there, and it's on the same there and on there, carries over several lines. Okay, so that's quite a very powerful way of doing things. Parallelisms, if I can say it, and variation. We saw that yesterday. Repeating a theme, repeating an idea, repeating a description reinforces that. Remember, this is all being delivered orally to an audience. You've got to keep them with you. Complex microstructures. That sounds good, doesn't it? Ring compositions. Okay, so what that means is, supposing you had five lines. That line would mirror that line would mirror that line, and that's what we call the kernel. And it works on quite a low level in terms of a few lines, but it also works on a grand level. So Beowulf begins with a funeral, ends with a funeral, and in the middle there's a major speech. So they could even think on such scale as that. They had things like kennings, so there is certain vocabulary which only occurs in poetry. Kennings is very familiar if you've done German, but basically it's where you take two words, which mean two different things, stick them together and it means something. So you might have the word Bahnhus, which is bone house, put them together, you've got a skeleton. Or Wal, way is road, Wal is a whale, whale, road, the sea. And they used to do that, just to try and make it more and more memorable. They also used formulas. I can't go much into this, but just basically there was an analysis of Old English poetry, and it came out of all kinds of theories. But basically, they found that certain half lines pretty much appear again and again and again in Old English poetry throughout all those texts. And there's quite a few of them. And what they came up with is it comes from a theory called oral formulaic. And basically, they said that if you are a poet and you're in an oral culture where you deliver everything, you're not writing down, you're not literate, The way you performed, the way you went into a mead hall, was you would have this store of half lines in your head and you could pluck them out anytime you want. And that's why we see these formulas again and again in this poetry. And therefore, what their argument was that all poetry, regardless of when it's written down, comes from an oral culture because we see these formulas again and again and again, which doesn't quite work. But anyway, that's oral formulaic theory. However, it is quite an interesting idea. And complicated syntax. I don't need to tell you any more about that because you saw it yesterday. So, Old English poetry. Two half lines. Each half line has two stresses or beats. Lines are linked by alliteration, but we also see internal rhyme. They have repeated phrases which they reuse. It was performed orally to an audience off the cuff from memory, usually pulling out half lines again and again. So if you're at 2005 line in Beowulf, you've done your A line, you're thinking, what the hell am I going to do a B line? I'll just throw in a B line that alliterates and keep yourself going. Does this remind you of anything? Well, it has reminded a few people of something. You can judge whether it reminds you of this. It's not a bad film, I don't think. But anyway, the point is, it's the only film clip I know of that type of setting. And people have put an analogy with the way the oral performance of Old English poetry to rap and things like that, in the sense that they have to, I mean, you would get thrown off the stage if you slip up. So the way to keep it going is to have things in your head and constantly bring them out. And you could see he was linking it by rhyme. That's how he followed it through. And you've got your stresses and beats. Alliteration, not so much, but anyway. Okay, authorship. Just to move on to the third thing. We know all the poems are untitled. We know it was an oral culture, eventually moving to a literate one. We know poems were written down around the year 1000. So who or what is an author in Old English? And this is a particularly difficult task and question to answer. And it's possibly why many, many people shy away from Old English. Because if you think of a lot of modern literary theory, it rests or resides on the facts that you have some contextual information about the poet or the context in which the poet was working. Not in Old English. It challenges you. So, for example, if we take Beowulf. Beowulf, we know, is written down around the year 1000, but the events in Beowulf are around the 6th century. So what does that mean? Did someone just decide to write something based 400 years ago? And who was it? Were the scribes, the people who wrote it down, were they the authors? It'd be handy if it was just one scribe, but the manuscript is actually two different hands. Did the author dictate it? Was the author one of the scribes? Is actually the point where the poem is composed. We know there are stories in Beowulf which appear, such as Sigurd, the dragon slayer, in Old Norse literature, 13th century. So, was Beowulf composed around this time, at the migration period, or before, or what happened? Or is it just that they just shared some common stories? 8th century, well, that's not too far from when they came over. Remember, Beowulf is set in Scandinavia, so it's talking about their ancestors, their roots. It's not too far from then, 8th century composition, so maybe the poem's then. But if it's oral and someone stands up and recites it and then you learn it and go away, well, you can change it. So basically, Beowulf probably changed and changed and changed and changed until it was written down there. At what point do you say there is an author there? This is the kind of thing that gave Roland Barthes nightmares. Okay, I'm going to finish with one poem. And it's a lovely poem called Deor, and I think it kind of brings things together. You'll find it everywhere. This is in Crossley Hollands. Deor is the title we give it, but of course we give it. Deor also means deer or animal, so it's a bit odd, really. But basically, it's a lovely little poem. So let's do it literally, what happens in it. It's a series of stanzas, which is quite odd for Old English poetry. You actually have stanzas, okay? And each stanza tells a bit of a tale from something which happened in the Germanic past, mythology or mainland Germanic history. And then the last stanza, you get this these lines from Deor himself, and he says, right, I'm now going to tell you my story. I was a poet. I was in the mead hall. I was doing absolutely fine. My job was secure. In comes another poet, and something happens. Was it like that sort of battle between Eminem and the other guy? I don't know, but there was something, and he gets ousted, and he doesn't have a job, and now he's wandering around trying to find a job. It appears in the Exeter book, so it's written down in the year 1000, but is there an earlier date? I mean, why would the people in the year 1000 have any idea who some of these characters are? Because they go back 5-6 centuries. So does that argue that actually the poem was written much earlier and it just survived and survived, and then someone around the year 1000 decided to write it down? And the lovely thing about the poem, each stanza talks about something usually horrible happening, and then at the end, it uses the line, that passed away, this also may, or so may this. That passed away, so may this. It's repeated 5 or 6 times in the poem. So basically what it's saying, things can only get better. Hey, look, I'm out of a job, but that passed away, so may this. Why might the Anglo-Saxons have liked it? Well, there's the obvious thing, consolation. Things can get better. Shit happens, but it does get better after a while. But also, these were a people who'd moved to a completely foreign land and settled down. So maybe they did like old stories about their roots and where they came from and their ancestors. Pretty much how people in the States are always trying to trace their roots back because they like those early stories. It gives them a sense of stability. And the Anglo-Saxons were in exactly the same boat. It is technically good and it is interesting poetry, interesting, particularly for that refrain at the end of each stanza. Who is the author? Who knows? Person who wrote it down? Is there really a person called Deor? Sounds a bit odd. Probably not. I mean, it's a similar poem called Widsith, which it's quite a long poem. It's not a particularly exciting poem, but it tells of this person who goes all around the place and meets all these people and talks about them like Attila the Hun and so on. Chronologically, it couldn't happen because these people lived too far, unless this person lived for several hundred years. And then when you look at the name, that means wide journey. So it's probably really not a person called Widsith. So is there a person called Deor? We doubt it. But also, it's a poem that links and interlaces with other aspects of Anglo-Saxon culture, going right back to that beginning, fusion. So the opening lines, Waylon knew the torment of serpents upon him, resolute man, he had suffered his hardships, he had sorrow and longing for his companions, pain of winter cold, he had often encountered misfortune, since Neith had laid constraints upon him, supple sinew bonds upon the better man, as that passed over, so can this. The story of Wayland, he's basically the smith of the gods. He gets captured, he gets hamstrung, there's hooks through his ankles, he can't escape, he's forced to make these things for Neithad. But that passed away, basically he escapes. That isn't the consolation, because when he escapes, he kills, before he escapes, I think, he kills Neithad's sons and makes drinking cups out of their skulls. Then he escapes, he rapes his daughter. The consolation is, which I know is hard pushed, but the consolation is she then gives birth to a great Germanic hero. But Waylon the Smith appears all over the place. There, if you go up the A34, there's the Neolithic tomb, which was called Waylon's Smithy by someone a long time ago. He also appears in Old Norse literature, so we start getting those links out. And even Wagner wrote something about him. Not that I advocate Wagner, but there we are. And when I think of Waylon, I think of the Frank's casket. So we've got a poem that's dealing with all these issues, and it's linking out, it's talking about links to Old Norse literature, etc., etc. But this is a lovely casket. I think I showed you this in the first lecture because of the runes. And there's Wayland on his little smithy, and there's probably Neithad enforcing him to do that, and there he is escaping. Classic Germanic pagan myths. Here is Christ with Mary. Here are the three wise men giving him his gifts. So the Adoration of the Magi, Waylon the Smithy, on the same panel from a casket made by the Anglo-Saxons sometime in the mid-7th century. Fusion, bringing things together, appropriation, whatever you want to talk about, balancing their beliefs, somehow getting it all through, which of course is where we came in with Halloween. And if you want nothing else for this lecture, just go away with that little dragon image in your head, because what I think, the way you think about Old English poetry, even on the way the lines are structured, it is that weaving, that interlace pattern that goes on in the poems, even at a grand scale with Beowulf. But also, I think this kind of thing, you see it again and again in their art, it captures the way they thought, that everything was linked. And if you carry on doing this subject, you will branch rapidly out from language and literature into archaeology, art history, to theology, to all kinds of things. You'll move into magic and all things like that. So you start bringing all these things. It's an incredibly powerful subject, an incredibly wide-ranging subject that links and weaves and tangles you up, but you can never escape it. So, summary. Old English poems are untitled and anonymous, mostly surviving form manuscripts, circa 1000 AD. They range from the dirty riddles right up to the epics like Beowulf, so don't ever just dismiss them as the boring dream of the rude or whatever or something like that. Tight structure, strict rules, performed orally. The skill of these people is immense. To actually go in and recite that poetry in front of a possibly hostile audience and get away with it and stick to those rules, having your A and your B line, your alliteration, your keeping up your stress patterns, and then put in things like ring patterns and overall structures. is absolutely extraordinary. And we're only getting a glimpse of it that was written down. But it does throw up issues of authorship, audience, performance, which you will pick up again and again and again in Anglo-Saxon literature, which is why it's fantastic. Next week, how does it survive? We'll do a bit more about manuscripts, and then we're going to move to prose, which some people think is boring, but I love prose because it's hilarious. And I'm going to talk about three of the famous prose writers briefly, Alfred, Alfrich, and Wulfstan, and you will go away with a bit of advice on why a pregnant woman should never eat acorns. Thank you very much. Thank you.